morning as we have an opportunity for remembrance, reflection, and dedication on our collective history here within Western Massachusetts. Today we're commemorating the year 2008, which is 30 years since the signing of the Northampton Consent Decree that was signed on December 7, 1978. That eventually led to a decision by the Department of the Commonwealth to close Northampton State Hospital 15 years ago on August 26th of 1993. I'd like to begin by providing you with a little bit of detail on our morning and then introducing our distinguished guests and presenters today. To acknowledge that we have refreshments at the back of the tent from our no-name snack bar. As many of you know, we have the Haskell Building open to you. There are facilities and restrooms in the building, and there are staff there that could guide you to those locations. Unfortunately, today we were not able to secure the services of an interpreter, so I do apologize for that. As many of you know, they're in very high demand, particularly here in our region. I'd like to acknowledge that there are tables in the back. We have a project that's been longstanding in Western Mass known as the Fountain Project, and there are materials there for people to view and to also purchase in terms of raising funds toward that initiative. You will receive or have available to you this morning's program along with a flyer that describes open houses within Northampton from many of our community partners. We also have provided a calendar of some events that are occurring during the month of October in recognition of mental illness awareness. And closing our program today, we'll have an opportunity for some short tours around the redevelopment of the property. And at the close, I will point out where, if you're interested in taking a tour, you could meet with tour guides. In the Haskell Building as well, we have a rolling video that actually shows the property and the interior of some of these buildings that's available for your viewing. And we also have a display of photography from the Northeast Center for Youth and Families. I would like to begin by acknowledging that we are at an extraordinary juncture today, and unfortunately for our program, many of our guests will need to leave close to noontime, so I just want people to be aware of that. And I would like to begin by welcoming again all of you to this event and acknowledging certainly, I see Representative Ellen Story has joined us this morning. Thank you so much. From Senator Rosenberg's office, we have Sean Berry representing the senator. From Representative Kokot's office, we have Diana Seisnell representing the representative. Thank you. We also have Mayor Ford of the City of Northampton here with us this morning. Thank you for your contributions throughout the years. And we also have other public officials from, certainly from the City of Springfield, City Councilor Jose Tosado. And I'm looking through the audience to see if, and we will have joining us, I don't see her here yet, Elizabeth Cardona representing Governor Deval Patrick this morning. From our Department of Mental Health, I'd like to introduce Commissioner Barbara Leadholm, who's here with us this morning, along with Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Elaine Hill. And I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. James Duffy, who's with us this morning. The members of our Western Mass Area Community Mental Health Advisory Board, thank you for being here. And most importantly, for also supporting and sponsoring this event this morning along with us. There are many providers, many advocates, many members of our community who have for decades worked collaboratively together, and I'm hoping that this morning will offer us an opportunity for a remembrance, reflection, and a renewal of our values. I do want to acknowledge that there is videotaping occurring, and also we have joining us from WFCR, Tina Antonini, who is over to my
I suppose my right. So I did want to acknowledge that. I'd like to begin by having Reverend Peter Ives join us up front for a dedication.
Good morning, and it's good to be here with you today. On this day, when we gather to commemorate the 30 years since the signing of the Brewster Consent Decree that led to the closing of the state hospital 15 years ago, I invite you to take time to remember, to celebrate, and to dedicate yourselves anew to the work that lies ahead. Let us take time to remember. Let us remember all the people who were here at the state hospital over the years. Let us remember the former patients who lived here. Let us remember them that we might honor them. Let us name them in our hearts that we might never forget their dignity as human beings. Let us remember the staff and the caretakers. Let us remember their dedication and service, the help they gave, the love they shared, the healing they facilitated, the community of support they nurtured. At the same time, let us never forget also the lives that were lost, the traumas that went unrecognized, the diagnoses that were wrong, the treatments that were harsh, the pain inflicted, the isolation and loneliness experienced. Let us remember both the good and the bad today and learn. And let us remember all people who have mental illness today and all those who support them. Let us take a moment of silence to remember. And let us also take time to celebrate the signing of the Brewster Consent Decree and the important reasons for closing the state hospital and all that has followed. Let us remember the successes of community-based community mental health. Let us celebrate the ways many, like our own community in Northampton, has responded with community-supported mental health services. Let us celebrate the way our whole community has worked to take responsibility for mental health for all who live in our midst. The caring and attentive ways of our mayor and city officials and the way they've responded, housing officials and teachers, police and firefighters, business owners, houses of worship, schools, community centers, shelters, including especially our own homeless shelter and hot meal program. Let us celebrate the way so many have come to feel a personal responsibility to help the mentally ill to feel they are not just in our community, but of our community and one of us. And let us remember the progress that has been made to create here on this village hill today a new community where those who still have mental illness and developmental disabilities can still have a home, a real home, on these grounds that once was the state hospital. And finally, let us take time to dedicate ourselves anew to the work that lies ahead. Let us dedicate ourselves to the ongoing challenges of supporting community-based community mental health. Let us individually and collectively refuse to succumb to the images of despair and the stigma so often associated with mental illness. In the words of Pat Deegan, a well-known ex-patient and activist, let us be a conspiracy of hope as we press back against the strong tide of oppression which for centuries has been the legacy of those labeled with mental illness. Let us refuse to reduce human beings to illness. Let us recognize that within each one of us there's a person, and that as people we share a common humanity with those who were diagnosed with mental illness. And let us recognize everyone's potential for recovery. And let us never give up hoping for recovery. Meaning, in Bill Anthony's words, that possibility of everyone living a satisfying, hopeful, and even contributing life, even with limitations caused by illness, and everyone being able to find new meaning and purpose and success in their lives as they grow beyond the catastrophic effects of mental illness. Let us dedicate ourselves to the work of support, healing, community building, and recovery that lies now before us all. Take care.
Introduce our commissioner, Barbara Leadholm, who will offer some opening remarks.
Can you hear? Yes, you can hear me. Not a good sign if I can't even find my opening remarks. Good morning. It is absolutely a stunningly beautiful day to be joining together and recognizing and observing a major celebration in the mental health world. On behalf of Governor Patrick and Secretary Bigby, I want to welcome you and honor your dedication to people with mental illness. Western Massachusetts is the vanguard, a leader in many efforts to break down the societal barriers of stigma, shame, discrimination, so that individuals with mental illnesses have the same right and rights to respect and dignity, and the assurance that every individual has the right to appropriate, least restrictive clinical services where they choose to live. 30 years ago, the Northampton Consent Decree was a first, not only for Massachusetts, but for the country, and its impact has been felt here and beyond. 15 years ago, the decision to close Northampton State Hospital was another significant milestone in this region. Your ability to work through the challenges of closing the hospital was commendable, as all interested parties worked together to hold the principles of community and the values articulated in 3 decades ago of thinking, of best practice, and commitment to our consumers. The shared vision and values of this landmark decree, together with the Foundation for Community-Based Mental Health Services in Western Mass, and the same vision and values resonate today as we emphasize that recovery for citizens with mental illnesses is a partnership with all of you, our consumers, our families, our advocates, providers, and the community. As you walk along the tours following the program, you will see before you a very powerful illustration of dedicated partnership among all of our stakeholders within the mental health community, the City of Northampton, and the Commonwealth. We acknowledge the foresight of Dukakis and the Weld administrations and of our Western Mass legislators. And again, I want to acknowledge Representative Story, staff from Representative Nagel and Representative Cocott, Senator Rosenberg, and the entire Western Mass delegation. You have ensured that the property of the former Northampton State Hospital is to be and was to be developed with the requirement that DMH consumers have housing and employment here. This serves to reinforce the values of recovery, resiliency, and most importantly, hope that individuals with mental illness matter, have a voice, and are never forgotten. As we reflect upon our history, we must use this observance to rededicate ourselves to the foundation that was built decades ago, to renew and reinforce the respect for personal autonomy and dignity of the individuals we serve. I want you all to know that my commitment remains to the principles of recovery and resiliency. We must strengthen and increase awareness of respect for consumers and families, dedicate our service to these principles, and really walk the talk of consumer involvement, self-directed care, and the ultimate goal of recovery for all citizens with mental illnesses. The life issues we all care about, employment, career building, education, living situations, personal empowerment, and quality of life, can be interrupted by mental illnesses. This can be devastating, and we all know it doesn't have to be, and often it is not. That is what hope can do. Restore those important connections to one's community, to employers, to families, to peers, and to social connections. Our goal is to help consumers reestablish normal roles in their communities. The consent decree put us on this path. Respect, dignity, and self-direction are cornerstones of our work. And most importantly, our starting point is always the strengths of every individual we serve. This is how we help create hope. I ask you to recommit your support and dedication to individuals with lived experiences in areas that define all of our citizens. This is also how we create hope. Today and every day, I am filled with hope because I know we have the capacity to draw upon our foundation, renew our commitment to recovery, resiliency, and vital partnerships that make it happen. And I'm sorry that I did not acknowledge the mayor. I want to also extend my appreciation for her coming here today. I want to actually have Elaine Hill join me just for a few minutes. Once again, I cannot underscore enough what you have done as leaders for really the mental health community and for Massachusetts. We're in pretty dire times right now, and actually the governor is going to be holding a press conference talking about fiscal outlook for the state. Elaine and I had planned on spending the day with you, and I'm disappointed to say that we'll be leaving at noon. But, you know, this is a time when we really need to rally together with a united voice, once again, understanding that there are always opportunities, even when we are facing fiscal challenges. And it's critical that we continue to focus on what you really started here. The momentum is something that the whole state, and certainly us at the department, and within this administration support. And we will continue to move forward, never wavering in terms of our commitment to supporting consumers living in the community, working in the community, and really having all the experiences that all of us aspire to in our dreams. And I'm going to give the mic to Elaine just for a couple minutes. And once again, Liz, I want to acknowledge your leadership here and the team of people that work with you. Your continued commitment. You're here every day doing what needs to be done, providing the leadership, and I am honored to be the commissioner for all of you. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm not here as the deputy commissioner as much as I'm here as someone who was a lowly peon back in 1972. When, as an employee of the first consent decree, the Ritchie v. Greenblatt, we were developing the first set of community services for the developmental disability population of the Department of Mental Health. And after a few years of doing that, it became apparent that there were a number of individuals who were challenged not only by developmental disabilities, but by psychiatric disabilities. So I came frequently to Northampton State Hospital. It was a very different scene. We had many more buildings. I was surprised to see how many aren't even here anymore. And the ones that were up were quite operational. It was a pretty large population of patients in the hospital. But I had a very memorable experience at Northampton that I'd like to share with you. I was maybe 23 years old. and I came up to see a gentleman that was going out into the community, and was about 2:30. It was a summer day, so I didn't have a coat on. And typically, I would just leave my purse in the trunk of the car. So I went in, and I talked to the man, and we made our plans, and then I knocked on the window to leave because it was time to go. And a mental health worker came, and I said, "It's time to go. I'm just telling you that I want to leave now." And he said, "Sure it is," and turned around and left. Now, this was a different shift. I came in on the first. This was the second. And I had a moment of utter panic. Clearly, I eventually got out. Luckily, they didn't do a mental status exam at that point to see if I should be allowed out. But I have some very fond memories of Northampton. And the thing that sticks with me all of these years later is that as transformational activities were happening on both the mental health part of the department and the mental retardation part of the department, it was very much a local activity. I remember very little intervention from Boston, but just about every aspect of this community was involved and problem solving and being creative, whether we were talking about the legislative delegation or the local community municipalities, if we were talking about the academic institutions. Everybody was putting forth their very best to make sure that these efforts were everything we wanted them to be. And I don't see any change in that. We're talking 30 years later, but we're still talking about the same kinds of partnerships with the same wonderful results. And even though the financial situation is extremely grim, I have every hope that this same manner of proceeding and problem solving will come to bear. So thank you for bringing me out this morning with the commissioner. I really feel very badly not to be able to see some of the programs this afternoon, but we will be back. Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to invite Rebecca McCauley to the podium to offer her remembrance and reflection. Thank you.
Can I clip this? Ha! Okay. Thank you all for coming. Lots more gray hair, I see. I remember. I had that same experience too. Ended a little differently. Oh, I could give you names. Yeah. Yeah, my trying to get out of here went a little differently. But I finally did. So thank you for coming here today. Thank you, George. It was very gutsy. I'm planning an outdoor affair. I mean, that's really amazing, and you did a great job. Thanks for having this. Now, where's George? George. We'll thank George when he comes. There he is. Okay, thanks for coming, everyone. And I'll just start with Northampton State Hospital. Like all roads to hell, this journey began with good intentions. A place to help people, beautiful building, soaring architecture, nice surroundings, good food, healthy environment for healing of body and soul. How did something that began with such noble ideals end up to be so damaging, damning, and deadly? Easy. Early on, the darker side of human nature took over. This place very quickly became a convenient place to put inconvenient people. It was easy to think that patients were being healed in the same way that students sent to Belchertown State School were being taught. It was a social euphemism that conveniently hid a much darker truth. The truth that people were in actuality being warehoused and locked away from polite society, not for their own good necessarily, but for the good of the people they left behind. I'm sure that sometimes families and loved ones really thought that something good was going to happen. Maybe sometimes something really did. But overall, being institutionalized was a living death sentence. Even if you ever got out, you still had that scarlet letter emblazoned on your reputation and your soul. For myself, I will live with that stain for the rest of my life. Even today, many years after my journey through this place, I still feel apart from the rest of society, As active as I have been, as busy as I am, working full-time with a full life, I still have this little part of me that says I'm not part of society, really. For others who are here, I remember that just before the place closed for good, many staff people would say this patient or that patient would never make it on the outside. They would point to this or that behavior, shake their heads, and wonder how the world will ever be able to function without a place like Northampton State Hospital to send these people to. What they did not realize was that the hospital environment actually caused many of these behaviors. Once these people were removed from here and basically retrained in how to cope with life in the community, these behaviors improved or totally disappeared. There have been a few other ex-patients who miss this place. They frankly miss the security. They miss being taken care of, miss not having to deal with the outside world. When I worked as a security guard up here after the closing, I would sometimes see friends of mine walking around the closed buildings actually missing it all, wistfully looking up at the windows of the memorial complex and wishing they had that security blanket back. I hate to say it, but these folks learned their patient roles well and had a lot of trouble making the adjustment back into regular people, or as regular as society would allow them to get, scarlet letter and all. Indeed, it was the memorial complex that we were all in over here. There are a few people left now who are housed in the main building, or as we called it, the main administration building, or as the preservationists called it, Old Main, with kind of a wistful quality. The Gothic monstrosity that is finally now gone. That building was put up in the phase where this was going to be a place of healing. By the time the 1900s came along, we were getting more realistic. The additions to the main building that came after it first opened were far more closer to the institutional norm. By the time I and my friends appeared, there were no illusions as to what this really was. The memorial complex was far more accurate in its architecture regarding the true meaning and purpose of Northampton State Hospital. A warehouse, a gulag, the end of the road. Our very own concentration camp right here in the Happy Valley. I remember sitting by the windows across the street, right over there, and looking out on Route 66 and the cars going by, wondering where each and every car was going, who was driving, what their lives were like, wondering if they had families, if they had a dog. It was the only escape I had. My reality was a grimy, smoke-filled day hall with nothing to do but endure ennui. When I was locked up in this building here, this building here, I had a really good view of the flagpoles out the windows. I looked up at the flag of Massachusetts and thought, wow, I'm a prisoner of the state. What did I ever do to get to this place? What did I ever do to become a ward of the state? That flag was a nice little twist of the knife. It symbolized just how deep the problem of institutionalization went and symbolized just how difficult it would be to change things. So, change did begin at the state level, instigated by the legal community, led by Steve Schwartz and Bob Fleischner and the Center for Public Representation. Bob, is Bob here? Back at the beginning of the consent decree, the state of Massachusetts actually said to our lawyers, yes, sue us. We know it's bad. Give us the tools we need to make the changes we need to make. Give us a legal instrument we can use to enforce these needed changes. And poof, the consent decree was born. Well, maybe not poof. Now, what were we up against? Mental health professionals who truly did not believe we could ever get better and be able to live in the outside world. A general public who did not want us around, and definitely not in their backyards. It would be an uphill battle all the way. Add to that the people who are employed here and did not want to lose their jobs. Northampton State Hospital had taken on a life of its own. It was the elephant in the room, the thing that no one ever wanted to talk about, but was an unavoidable fact of life in Northampton and the region. We needed legislation to finally kill the beast. What we went through. People who are trained into patienthood did not make the adjustment easily. In the early days, the local newspaper made constant indictments of the Department of Mental Health by vilifying the patients they let go. That's actually where I got my start as an advocate, standing up to all this directly with the paper and the mayor of Northampton, who was also attacking us, not our current mayor. The police department learned on the fly how to deal with patients who were in the community and behaving badly, unfamiliar with the new social requirements. Picket demonstrations by neighbors finding out they had ex-patients living in their neighborhood. It went on and on. Through all the turmoil, eventually things started to even out. We still get little glimpses of the old days when a new residence opens up in a neighborhood and other people are unhappy, but it's nothing like it was before. As a sidebar, the main building and later on the entire site became the haunted house on the hill par excellence. It attracted curious people from all over the country, people who wondered what it was like to be a patient here, people who just wanted to get scared. As a security officer up here, it was my job to catch these people. I worked the overnight shift. I had a total blast doing this. I had the most arrests with convictions of any guard who was ever up here. One of my favorite exercises when I caught someone, had them detained, waiting for the state police to arrive, I would ask them just what they came up here for. Often they just said to get scared. They heard the place was really spooky and haunted. I would just lean over them and say, "Boo! I am the scariest thing you're gonna see up here." If they really wanted to get scared, I would tell them the truth about what it was like to be here as a patient. Ironically though, I don't think they're ever really interested in the reality of the patient experience. Of course, some of them did get the prisoner experience, which is somewhat similar. Okay, flash forward now. It's years later. The beast is dead. But is it really? I actually don't think so. It lives on in psychiatric wards and general hospitals, which I don't have too much of a problem with, believe it or not. Yeah, sometimes you do need to get away for a bit. It's too bad, it's to a mental ward right now, but it's a damn sight better than being written off forever in an institution. General hospitals don't want people there forever. It's not cost effective. Hey, I'll take it. In my perfect world though, there will be more respite facilities, more in-house treatment for people having psychotic breaks. I truly do think that having a psychotic break should not dictate how you live the rest of your life. I truly believe that a person having a psychotic break would eventually be able to recover fully if they were helped through it in the right way from the start. It would be labor intensive at the start, but the long-term benefits to both the person and society would be incalculable. But that's just me. However, we have now already seen how much an institution contributes to the bad behavior of people who are already having problems. We have seen here that people getting out of institutions who were totally written off by everyone, professionals included, could vastly improve just by being away from places like this. The Windhorse Project here in Northampton has the right idea. Help people where they are, help them recover where they are. Of course, they're not medication oriented. So for now, they're the orphans of mental health care reform. No pharmaceuticals, no money. But it is the direction we need to go. Even SAMHSA gets it, the SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the federal level of mental health care. They have an ad series on television now. Maybe you've seen it. The tagline is, "Mental illness, what a difference a friend makes." Ain't it the truth? That really says it all. What a difference a friend does make. What a difference human being-oriented help makes. Not drugs, not hospitals, maybe someone's couch to crash on for a few days and some caring words, I don't know. I really don't have a definitive answer for how to deal with the phenomenon we currently call mental illness, because that's such a varied thing and different for everyone who goes through it. But I do know that help for people needs to be tailored to the person and their individual needs. You cannot take someone who's having major mental problems and lock them up with 50 other people who are also having major mental problems and expect them to get better. There's only one reason for doing that, and that reason is expediency for the people sending them there. The danger is always with us, though, to backslide. I remember once attending a meeting of the Save Old Maine group. They actually asked me to come. I said, "Do you know who I am?" At some point, someone said, "Yes, we can really make it nice and show them how it's done." I said, "Stop right there. How what can be done? Make it really nice, a nice place to lock people up? Really nice surroundings, good food, healthy environment. Isn't this how this whole sleigh ride began?" But that's how all of this can begin so easily once again. It will seem like a good idea at the time. It will seem convenient and cost effective. We will rationalize it by saying something like, "Well, it's for their own good." We might even make the accommodations really nice to make us feel better about what we're doing. That is how it will all begin again, mark my words, here today. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts is enlarging Worcester State Hospital right now. They're making it nicer. Okay, we must remain vigilant about this. We can never forget what happened here. This was failed social policy that we need to hold up as an example of what does not work, and never let it happen again. Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Cardona, who's representing Governor Patrick. She's the director of our Western Mass office and will present a citation.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here this morning on behalf of Governor Patrick and the Patrick Murray administration. I also want to salute Mayor Higgins and Representative Story. Before I begin, I just want to add that, you know, I'm certain that if we went around and asked everybody, we probably know a neighbor, a friend, a colleague, or even a family member who suffers from mental illnesses. And so today, this place actually brings me back to when I was a child, and oftentimes I didn't know that Northampton was a city or a town back then. Instead, it was like the boogeyman, a place where people were locked away, and I did have the opportunity to come here and visit, and it was a very unpleasant place. And so I am so delighted that we have an administration and a commissioner and the leadership of Liz and her staff and so many people who are advocating not just for the services but also reaching out to the individual communities, because with all of this you have to have culture competency in mind. And so I'm honored to be here today to present this citation from the governor. On behalf of the citizens of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we are pleased to confer upon your organization this governor's citation in recognition of the 30 years of dedicated services in mental health advocacy in Western Massachusetts. And it's a new direction with new energy, and congratulations to all of you for your efforts.
Public representation.
That's a bad start.
You head to the right, it's
easier. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been asked to make a few reflections on the consent decree and the path that followed from it, so I would like to do that. We started at the State Hospital in 1973 as something that was known very politically incorrectly as the Mental Patients Advocacy Project, a name that we probably would not be using today. Mr. Goggins and Dr. Jacobs welcomed in a cadre of lawyers. We were among the first group of attorneys and the largest group of lawyers, I think, to find their way into a mental hospital anywhere in the United States. And we began representing people on the wards and in the hospital and at commitment hearings. And over again, we would approach them and ask them, what did they want? We asked David Brewster and Hector Santiago and Donald Gabori and Richard Snyder, what do you want? And over again, what they said to us is, we want to leave. We want to go home. So we went to their social workers and their clinicians and their doctors and said, David Brewster would like to leave. And the clinicians inevitably said to us, well, he should be able to leave. But unfortunately, there's nothing available for him. There is no place where he can go. So being lawyers, advocates, we went back and said, sign this 3-day notice. This will get you out. And they signed a 3-day notice in the hospital. Dr. Gallup or someone would inevitably file a commitment petition, and off we'd go to a hearing in the basement of the building that used to be over there with Judge Morse. And we would put on a good case, and Judge Morse would listen, and Dr. Geller or Dr. Gallup would testify that this person's got a mental illness, but they don't need to be at this hospital. And we think that they should leave, but unfortunately, there's no place where they can go and be safe. And Judge Morse, over and over and over again, would enter orders of commitment, often with sadness and almost always with exasperation, telling us, one of the things that Judge Morse did wonderfully was talk to people. He was a terrific judge. He would always explain his decision. And he would explain it to our client and to us, saying that he was sorry, he wished that they could leave, he thinks that they should leave, but until the Department of Mental Health was able to provide something for them in the community, they couldn't leave, and they'd be committed. All this was happening at a time and in a backdrop, some of the things Elaine talked about. There was a consent decree at Belchertown State School. Interestingly enough, that case is still going on. Yesterday, the First Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts could close the Fernald State School. But that was going on. There were cases all over the country, particularly in mental retardation facilities, establishing a right for people to live in the community when they didn't need to be in hospitals. There was also a lot of law. There was a very good federal statute establishing community mental health centers. Massachusetts had a wonderful statute, even in the early 70s, saying it was the policy of Massachusetts that people should live in the community in the least restrictive alternative. But the Department of Mental Health was without the resources to do that, and the community services just were not there. We would often, at the commitment hearings, have two options for people. If you were from Springfield, you could go to Mrs. Laragione's, if she had any openings. You remember that one? Yeah, not what we would say today was the greatest place to go. But she was a caring person who provided something for a lot of people who were able to leave. If you were from Franklin, Hampshire, you had an option of a couple of group homes. There were community mental health centers, but that was about it. There was a frustration at the hospital, there was a frustration among clinicians, and there was a clear frustration among the administration of the Department of Mental Health that something had to be done. So we did it. On December 15th in 1976, we filed a lawsuit, filed a complaint in the federal district court. It was one of the first complaints in the United States directed at a mental hospital as opposed to a mental retardation facility. It was a class action. We had 9 named individuals as plaintiffs, led by David Brewster. We were joined in the case by the Massachusetts Association of Mental Health, as far as I know, the only time that MAMH has been a plaintiff in a lawsuit, and by the Massachusetts Association for Retarded Citizens, now known as ARC Massachusetts. As Elaine Hill pointed out, the back wards of the Haskell building were a mental retardation facility. There were two back wards in this building with a number of individuals who had been moved from the Belchertown State School in order to get the census down there to Northampton State Hospital because they had co-occurring mental disorders with their mental retardation. So Mark was a plaintiff as well. The case is called Brewster versus Dukakis because Governor Dukakis was the governor and he was the first named plaintiff, first named defendant. Commissioner Robert Okun was a defendant, as was the late Ray Breen, who was then the regional director, that day's equivalent of the area director, and five of the area directors, Joe Van Honecker, Andy Phillips, Frank Robinson was a defendant, he's here, Carrie Holland, and Evelyn McLean. Dr. Jacobs, who was the superintendent, was a defendant. We were fortunate to draw Judge Frank Friedman as the judge in this case. At that time, Judge Friedman had just begun to move the federal court into Springfield so that there was a full-time federal court sitting in Springfield for the first time. The first year or so of the case was litigated. Surprisingly enough, or not surprisingly enough if you've ever been sued, although as Becky McCauley pointed out, we were somewhat invited to bring this lawsuit. When we brought it and people were actually served, the reaction was a little different than what we'd hoped for. And the case was contentious for about a year. A turning point in the case was when Steve Schwartz filed a motion asking the judge to invite the Department of Justice to join the case as a plaintiff. The Department of Justice has done a lot of litigation around the country on mental hospitals and had been very involved at that case that time in Wyatt versus Stickney, which is the grandmother and grandfather of all the institutional cases. And that one just ended about 2 years ago. Judge Friedman said he wasn't going to do that, and he wanted the parties to start meeting together to try and see if they could settle the case. And if they couldn't, then he'd think about inviting justice in. It was at that point, I think, that the most remarkable part of the early stages of this case happened. We're very fortunate throughout the history of the case to have great representation from lawyers in the Department of Mental Health, particularly Dick Ames, and in the Attorney General's office from a long line of very good lawyers, Bill Pardee, Steve Rosenfeld, and others, Catherine White. A lot of lawyers in this case have gone on to be judges and commissioners in other areas, and as have a lot of the defendants. But the parties got together and began a planning process. And the planning process involved the local administrators from DMH, the lawyers from our side, and experts from that each side brought in. And the result of that planning was, I think, the first comprehensive look in the United States at a major geographical part of a state. A look into seeing how many people actually are out there with serious mental illness who might be in need of hospitalization, and what kind of services would be necessary to keep them from having to go to the hospital for any long period of time and to get them out. The consent decree itself is 31 pages. The planning document, which is attached to it, is 250 pages. And that's the document that came out of this planning process. And it said, we need so many residential programs. We need emergency services, which were unheard of at that time. We need community mental health centers. We need employment opportunities. We need job training and retraining for hospital staff. The decree was signed with that as the attachment on December 7th in 1978, shortly before Governor Dukakis left office after being defeated in a primary election by Ed King earlier that year. The decree created an opportunity for perhaps the most comprehensive community-based mental health system in the United States. And despite a long period of resistance, particularly during the King administration until Governor Dukakis came back in, I think it's worked. And it's worked for a number of reasons. And these are some of the ones that I think are particularly important. We had, in this state at that time, and in this part of the state in particular, an extraordinary collection of DMH administrators. And I don't say that just because they're all here. but it's true. Right? We had people of vision, of commitment, and with a sense of values and hard work that really made it quite remarkable. We had good lawyers on our side and on the state side. We had a terrific administration in the Department of Mental Health most of the time at the state level. We had responsible and professional assistant attorney general. We had strong support from the court. Judge Freeman believed in this case, perhaps in part because he was very happy he didn't have to go to trial, and he was just able to oversee a consent decree, but he believed in it. We had remarkable court monitors. Michael Ponser, who was the first court monitor, was an extraordinary addition to the implementation of the decree, kept all of us working together, working in a toward common goals. And Joe Cecilia, who succeeded him when Michael Ponser went on to succeed Judge Friedman as the federal judge in Springfield, was also a very important factor in the decree. We had a committed, innovative, visionary group of providers. It really is, when you think back, I was remembering with someone just a little earlier about the small agencies that started up with new ideas to serve elders, to serve people with severe medical problems, to serve people with dual diagnoses, and to do that against community resistance, to stand up in some of the areas where these programs are not welcome, to find new ways to deliver services. It was really very extraordinary. Another thing that I think is unique and remains unique is that Michael Hogan, when he was the regional director, brought in and infused throughout the system a clear values base. He actually hired Michael Kendrick to be